Good evening. This is one of a series of book talks that are sponsored by the library here at JTS. This has actually been a busy afternoon for us at the library. We had, as some of you know, an open house earlier this evening, and I hope that these two programs didn't eat into one another. It gives us an opportunity to celebrate in a very short period of time some of the great riches we have at the institution, both some of the things that we hold in our collections, as well as the resource which is our faculty and the work that they do. I have had the privilege of reading Alan Middleman's book, Hope in a Democratic Age, and before bringing him to speak about what he's written and provide you with the opportunity to engage him in conversation. Let me just say that if you have not yet read the book or if you haven't yet read Alan's other books, this I think would be a good place to start. He is a writer who writes with a combination of sophistication and lucidity and just, you know, complete command of the material in a way that makes available to a reader like me, that is to say a non-specialist, things that could otherwise be very, very difficult. And yet, as I read this, it was also clear to me that I was not being cheated in terms of the complexity or sophistication. It is a wonderful tour through some of the great philosophers, both Jewish and in the broader tradition, who engage the question of hope. And I have to say, I don't know whether you expressed the same surprise in reading the description or whether you experienced the same surprise as I did, but I have to confess that it never occurred to me until I saw the description of this book and then read through the book very, very carefully that hope might be expressed as a virtue. It was a thoroughly novel idea to me, as Alan makes clear in his discussion. It's not a way we're accustomed to thinking of hope. And I must say that, Alan, you've actually changed my life since I read the book. I don't know how long the change will last, but, you know, for the time being, you know, you've changed my life because I've always thought of myself as a very hopeful person, but now I'm more self-critical in my hopefulness, meaning, you know, I hope that it's no longer just a naive emotion, but it's actually a virtue that I hold, that I aspire to, something that I approach with kavanah. So if what I just said kind of interests you, tantalizes you, and you have not yet read the book, you will be certainly very interested, I'm sure, by what Alan has to say. Beyond that, I could not recommend the book more highly. Thank you for being here. Alan Middleman.
So thank you very much for coming out. Or sticking around if you're in the building on such a wet and unpleasant night. I really appreciate it. Thank you, David, for the very flattering introduction. I take it as genuine and high praise from you that you found the book both lucid and also sophisticated at the same time. I recalled one of the classes I took at Brandeis as an undergraduate was with the late great historian of Jewish philosophy, Alexander Altman, and it turned out to be his last class that he taught at Brandeis. It was in the third book of the Guide for the Perplexed, and at the end of his Brandeis teaching career in our last class, he stood up and he said, "If there's anything I can ever do for any of you, please do not hesitate to contact me." And then he started to cry a little bit, and he quickly left the room. So this is a world-shaking event for Alexander Altman to begin to tear up. So some years later, I completed my dissertation on a German Jewish figure, Isaac Breuer, and I remembered Professor Altman's invitation. So I wrote him, and he immediately wrote back and said, "I would very much like to read your manuscript. please send it to me. So I sent it to him, and within about a week and a half, he wrote back to me, and he praised it in some respects, but then he said, it is, of course, more popular than scholarly. So this was as if someone had taken a sword and just disemboweled me. So I asked a friend of mine who had gotten his PhD at Brandeis with Altman how I should take this, and he just laughed. And he said, oh, that means it's readable. So that's sort of been my aspiration, my hope, and my standard all along, to try to be suitably rigorous and sophisticated, but also lucid and accessible, if not quite popular. As David indicated, this book tries to flesh out in a contemporary philosophical idiom an ancient thesis. And the ancient thesis, a little bit more explicit in Christianity than in Judaism, although I think it's fully there in Judaism with everything but the terminology. The thesis is that hope is best understood as a virtue. In our modern philosophical tradition, going back to the 17th century, we've constructed hope as well as fear and other such items as emotions or passions, as they used to be called. And if you read the kind of classic canon of modern philosophers, Descartes, Hobbes, Locke, Spinoza, David Hume, not Kant, curiously, they all talk about hope as an emotion whose opposite is fear. And emotion, or in the older language, passion, is something that happens to us. We are passive in the face of this wave of uncontrollable feeling that comes unbidden upon us. And on the old philosophical story, what we have to do is control these passions because they can bring us down dangerous paths and make us vulnerable. The ancients, who have a much richer understanding of passion than the moderns do, also treat hope, when they treat it at all, as an emotion. And as an emotion, they find it to be rather dangerous. So the Greek treatment of hope, for the most part, in epic, in poetry, in tragedy, in philosophy, is rather negative. Hope appears almost as a vice. It is a mark of the abandonment of reason. It represents the triumph of wishful thinking over a prudent, sober, clear-eyed view of the world. The most you should hope for on the account, say, of the ancient skeptics is to overcome hope, because hope makes you vulnerable. If hope is some kind of positive expectation for the future, if hope is the desire that events will turn out in an advantageous way rather than a disadvantageous way, it makes you dependent on something that is not yet the case. It makes you dependent on something that is radically out of your control. It therefore makes you vulnerable to contingency, just as you're vulnerable to the torrent of passions represented by anger or grief or something like that. In the case of hope, you're vulnerable to fragility of history, of contingency. So the ancient Greeks and the Romans are very, very dismissive of hope. Not so the ancient Israelites and the Jews and the Christians. The Psalms, in particular, are full of affirmations of hopeful persons. Those who, as we're bidden in Psalm 27 that we recite from Elul through the high holiday period. Kevei el Adonai chazak v'emetz libecha v'kevei el Adonai. That we should hope in the Lord, and we should be strong. We should hope in the Lord and take courage. That's virtue language. I mean, it doesn't use the Greek term, arete, obviously, and there's not quite a Hebrew term that lines up with the Greek concept of virtue. But virtue is an excellence of character under a form of life, some shared form of life. And the Psalms routinely praise those who are miachalim lechasdo, who are hoping for God's chesed, for God's covenant loyalty. Now, it's not just enough to call hope a virtue and to say that virtue is a more capacious category than emotion. You have to have a good rationale for doing this. So what is my rationale? I want to say that hope in its categorization as more than emotion contains within it some kind of knowledge or some kind of wisdom. That hope discloses something to us in the act of hoping, in the commitment to hope. That hope gives us a kind of truth that a mere emotional response to our circumstances does not give us. There's a long, complicated story we could tell about the relationship between emotion and reason, which I try to work out in the book in terms of contemporary philosophy of mind, but I'm not going to talk about that now. I'd like to make the claim that when we hope, we are making an affirmation, and it's an affirmation of the goodness of being. It's something that we draw from and sense and actualize and instantiate in the act of hoping in the present, but we also want, we desire to see that felt, intuited goodness endure and prevail in the future and indeed be realized at a higher amplitude than is possible in the present. So hope has a future character, but it also has a sort of present power to it. And I think this corresponds logically to the structure of a virtue. If you look at a classic virtue, andrea, courage, in the Greek tradition, virtue has an instrumental quality, that is, it's a means to an end. You want courageous men in battle so that you can win the battle. But there's also an inherent excellence in a virtue such as courage that makes it have intrinsic value in the philosophical jargon, not just instrumental value. The very excellence of living courageously in the here and now is its own reward. You know, schar mitzvah, mitzvah. The reward of a virtue is the virtue itself, not just the end that it intends. I think this is true of hope. I think that hope, in its capacity as an affirmation of the goodness of being here and now, has as its opposite despair. Hope resists despair, despondency, nihilism, fatalism, hard determinism. Hope asserts a kind of wisdom about the nature of human being and about the field of human possibilities. That, in a very, very broad sort of way, is what I try to argue for in the book. But, of course, there's more to the argument than this. When we look at the conditions that can sustain this hopeful orientation, we find that hope is always tied to a story. And for Jews and for Christians, the story that underwrites this virtuous orientation of hope is a biblical story, a story about a saving God who cannot tolerate injustice, who liberates a people, who is a source of goodness and of value in being, and who commissions people to act in manners imitative of the goodness of this supreme source of value. Okay, but what if you don't have that story? You know, what if your story is a Buddhist story about the emptiness of being, the suffering of being, the burden of time? Then what? Does this kind of radical orientation of hope that I'm suggesting come down to accepting some sort of narrative, which isn't really based on anything other than our desire to believe that it's true, that is, other than an assertion of cultural will to keep the narrative going? So is hope, in a sense, tautological? Does it simply feed on itself like a dog chasing its tail? Or does hope really draw from a deeper source that we can get at through a metaphysical analysis? In other words, is there a higher warrant for the affirmation of the goodness of being that is hope than there is a warrant for nihilism, for despair, for some sort of negativity? I try to make that case in the book. But to make that case, I have to take, broadly speaking, the pessimist tradition very seriously, going back to the unhopeful Greeks and seeing more modern thinkers who explicitly reject hope, not just hope for this and that, but hope per se. Spinoza very much rejects hope. Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and there are others. So the book is sort of run as a dialogue between a tradition that sort of enshrines hope in virtuous terms as a choice against despair, as a way of ordering life toward an ultimate good, versus a tradition that finds that really foolish and a fool's errand. You know, as I always try to tell my students, you dare not stack the deck in favor of your favorite position. You have to get a genuine dialectic going where you interpret these views at their strongest articulation philosophically and see which one has the better warrant behind it. So part of what I do in the book is a kind of articulation of, in philosophical language, of the views I think inhere in theological sources, Jewish and Christian, and going back to scripture and the rabbis and the church fathers. But there's nothing dogmatic about this. From my point of view, this is just cultural source material, and the ultimate truth of it is up for grabs, and I have to argue the ultimate, or the least believable truth of it, on philosophical grounds, not through what Rosenzweig would call fanaticism. That is just defaulting to the acceptance of revelation. Another piece of the book, I thought I would do this by reading from the book, but since I'm talking about it, I guess I'll just continue in this way. Another thing that I try to do, and given away by the title, Hope in a Democratic Age, is to understand what a so-called politics of hope would look like on my account. We hear a lot about this, and hope is brooded about in a very casual, very promiscuous way, whether through calling us rhetorically to give ourselves over to its audacity, or being told cynically and dismissively being asked, how's that Hopi changey thing working for you? In fact, I think my book actually came out sort of at the wrong moment, because I think there's a conservative backlash against hope talk and seeing it as basically undisciplined. As my thesis is that if we want to talk about it as a virtue, which I think is the best way to talk about it, talk about virtue in the classic Aristotelian sense is a mean between the distortions of the extremes. So virtue, one of the features of virtue is that it can give an account of itself. It has reason on its side. So if hope is to play a role in a democratic polity, as I believe it must, it has to be a pretty sober form of hope. It has to be straightened. You know? It has to be disciplined. It cannot be audacious and expansive. It cannot engender extreme expectations for what a small d democratic politics can achieve. It ought to be very very modest, but nonetheless very real. So I try to argue through the last couple of chapters of the book for what a straightened, sober, virtuous conception of hope could look like in terms of a political theory. And the argument goes something like this. Going back to my earlier argument for virtue, that it has both intrinsic and instrumental value, hope makes an affirmation of the goodness of being now, and so offers a kind of wisdom about how to be in the world. But it also anticipates some sort of future in which human beings can flourish. So what would that dual temporal structure look like in terms of a political theory or political implications? Seems to me in the modern period, hope has been co-opted by modern politics purely as a warrant for emancipation. A license for ever greater degrees of liberation from the status quo. And if you read the people who write about hope in political terms, they're never political conservatives. They're always progressives. And they're always talking about, what new barrier we can break down, what current status quo we can overturn. Hope always seems to be going beyond what is toward the realization of something that's not yet. The largest book on hope in the Western tradition, 3 volumes, going like 1,500 pages, is by a German-Jewish Marxist philosopher named Ernst Bloch, Das Prinzip Hoffnung, The Principle of Hope. I read about 500 pages. I thought that was enough. I think I got the point, because Marxists are very repetitive. It's a brilliant book, I think a deeply, deeply flawed book. But he invokes this concept of 2 kinds of future, a future that is pretty much like the present, just ameliorated, and a future that's so radically different we can't envision it. We can't imagine it. This is the novum. This gets picked up by Christian theologians like Jürgen Moltmann. I'd be wrong with that kind of picture for a democracy. I think democracy has to eschew utopia. It may work into the unknown, but it has to work into the unknown of the future on the basis of confidence in the institutions of the past, such as the Constitution. So the political theory upshot of my view of hope as a virtue, that is, what does hope mean as a civic virtue, is something like this. You can only affirm goodness in being if being is meaningful. If being is meaningless, if nihilism, if despondency, if despair are the proper attitudes for life, eo ipso life is meaningless. Life is absurd, and you can't even rise to Camus' hopeful response to absurdity as he does in The Rebel. You have nothing but resignation and you find some kind of stoic grandeur in the acceptance of fate, in the resignation to fate. No. If we want to affirm hope, we have to affirm the meaningfulness of our lives, and lives are meaningful because they're shared in communities that have practices and institutions and stories and forms of intersubjectivity that shelter us from nihilism and from despondency and despair. So this is to say a conservative dimension, so to speak. Hope recognizes that in order for there to be meaningfulness, there have to be ongoing institutions that shelter human beings and provide for meaning. Maybe I'll just read you one little bit from the end of the book about this. It is in the institutions of civil society that persons learn to hope. Parents teach children, when all goes well, to trust, share, respect, listen, assess, and judge. They teach them to have confidence in the family's values. They show them that they are loved and that they can love in return. The interactions of family members are the matrix out of which hope, as the intuition of the goodness of being and as the expectation of the flourishing of goodness in the future, grows. Traditions and institutions that shape families, especially the religious communities, provide languages, symbols, practices, and opportunities for the further articulation of value. The intuition of goodness can rise to affirmation in a moral vocabulary inherited from tradition. It is one thing to feel the sheer power and pleasure of, say, animal vitality within oneself. It is another to understand it through the story of Genesis, where God pronounces his creation good. To embrace a story allows for a more ramified affirmation. Religious traditions give order, endurance, and narrative coherence to intuitions, emotions, and glimpses of value. They order worlds of meaning. Truth-bearing stories, as we have seen, are the seedbeds of virtue. Civil society institutions nourish hope in another way. They are forums for human agency, spaces where persons can engage together in action, in Hannah's sense. As hope is tied to agency, schools where agency is stimulated, deployed, nurtured, and tested are essential if hope is to be cultivated. Persons need to learn that their action can matter. It is more likely that action can matter in the little platoons, a phrase of Burke, one of the thinkers I look at, than in the anonymous spaces of a mass society. If citizen participation, that is, deliberative democracy, is what counts, then skills of participation learned in non-political settings are essential. The immense charitable, educational, social service, social capital building enterprise of houses of worship is a powerful framework for schooling and agency. Persons not only do good, they learn the skills of doing good. They learn that hope can be fulfilled. Hope is ratified by projects that succeed at a local level on a manageable scale, where persons enact their values through cooperative action and achieve something tangible. Hope is shown to have traction, to be plausible and warranted. The investment of hope in cooperative public action at the level of civil society makes sense. All the more reason that government should assist, or at least refrain from encouraging spontaneous, hopeful projects of the voluntary and traditional communities that prize civil society. So I have an argument running through the book. That's a civil society argument. In a way, that's a sort of libertarian argument for a government that doesn't hold people by the hand or overwhelm people with its assistance, but government that allows people to find ways of their own agency being powered and flourishing. In the name of this relatively conservative understanding of hope as that which to identify and protect civil society institutions in which lives flourish. Without, I hope, slighting the genuinely emancipatory dimension of hope as it looks to greater equity, greater participation, greater agency in the future. So I try the last chapter to ask actual means for some public policy items, things like charters and other areas of public policy. At the time I was writing the book, the whole question of the faith-based initiative was very prominent. So there's an argument here for sort of allowing religious institutions with their different versions of human possibility not to conform themselves to purely democratic and liberal norms, because the project of a liberal society with its view of endless emancipation will inevitably disappoint, I think, seeing day to day with the current administration. We invested so much hope in it, but you know, now we're back to reality, and I think we need traditional visions, sources, currents of hope, such as you get from religious traditions, to be a counterbalance to the overblown promise from secular politics or from secular ideologies in general. And so a secular, democratic, liberal order actually needs traditional, non-democratic sources of hope to offset its off-effective promises. That's part of the... So, to sum up, it's a book that I think treats with equal seriousness philosophy of mind, philosophy of the emotions, metaphysics, religious sources and the theologies built upon them, the Greek and modern philosophical traditions, political theory, and a little bit public policy. And at the heart of the book is an exegesis of Thomas Aquinas, who has the most, I think, developed view of hope in the Western tradition, and happily enough, Joseph Albo, the 14th, early 15th century Iberian Spanish Jewish thinker, who also has a chapter on hope in Sefer HaIkarim. So my big question is, what should this book be in at Barnes & Noble? You know, is it political science? Is philosophy? It's really so. If you buy a book on Amazon, of course it doesn't matter. But it is in some chain bookstores, and it's in the religion section. I asked them if they would put it in book culture. It's in book culture, the main one, but they also said they'd put it in the one on Broadway, and there it's just going to be in generic nonfiction books. Anyway, I hope I've given you a little bit of the flavor of what I tried to do in the book without too much of my purple prose. Sure.
What's the primary? Is it under religion? Or is it under philosophy? And what's I looked? What subject matter is it? This is a very diverse question.
Yes. Well, that's. How would I know that?
Have you checked it on WorldCat?
I did check it on WorldCat, and I was really happy that dozens of primo academic libraries around the world, the English-speaking world, have the book. So I was straight in. It's published by OUP UK, and so it got pretty good distribution around the United Kingdom and even into India and Australia and Canada. And it came out in the U.S. some months after that. And my wife was very incensed by this because they took my American English spellings and they anglicized them. So neighbor picks up a U, and labor picks up a U, and color and center gets, you know. So my wife thought that made me sound pretentious, but I had nothing to do with it. So I don't know the answer to your question, but
sometimes there are letters of Congress, the United States Letter of Congress, that will have the cataloging, the pre-publication cataloging right there, but it's not. It's always developed.
I guess I'm happy with it being in religion, you know, next to Eckhart Tolle and following your spirit guides and stuff like that. Zach?
At the end of the second chapter, it seems like you
Oh, you read the book. Mazel tov.
Okay.
You only get half credit for it.
It seems that there's a, what you call thoughtful religionists and atheists, as well as historical communities, to truly be able to dialogue. They need to be able to speak Greek to one another, in a sense, reason fulfilling that role. So I guess the question is, if you reject the philosophical anthropology of the Greeks, right? If it's fair to sort of paint them with one brush, is that problematic? And I guess along those lines, is it probable? Does the polity that you envision therefore also require a certain degree of Greek and or a sort of paganist thought in order to hold it together?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the pagan. I don't think. I mean, the on the political, thought side of the book, I don't think a self-governing polity, a democracy or a republic, can really survive unless the citizens have some confidence in the efficacy of their own agency. Unless they think hope is very much tied to agency. And that's an argument I make in the more philosophical front end of the book. Hope, if we live determinist to the point of fatalist, there's no possibility of influencing the way the world goes, then I don't think there's much reason to hope. I mean, maybe you could still argue for some value in being in some kind of radical, isolated present. But it seems to me if there's no future, the present dies too. There's a movie I saw a few years ago. I recommend it if you haven't seen it. It's called The Children of Men. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a science fiction thing, but it's based on the idea that women, everybody becomes sterile, and there are nobody can have children anymore. And what do people do in these dread latter days when they realize that everyone is going to die and there'll be no humanity left? And of course, it's a future, dystopia kind of movie, but there's something to it. So I think without futurity, the present also loses its meaningfulness. And it seems to me that understandings of human agency that see all deeds as essentially tragic to democracy, I think a democracy can do better with Aristotle and even Plato, because they both have notions of a doable good that can be realized by human agency in a teleological way, in a future-oriented way, in which a society in which human beings can truly flourish is achievable in some way. On a more tragic view, where every choice involves some tragic trade-off, I'm not sure you can sustain the confidence democratic citizens need to run a democracy. If existentialism were the best account of human agency, human nature, futurity, I think we probably would want to turn the lights off on democracy. So I'm very concerned to see if I can give a philosophical validation, not just in this book, but in my work in general, to a non-tragic understanding of the human condition. By non-tragic, I don't mean Pollyannish. That is a non-tragic estimation of the human condition. it surely recognizes the immensity of human suffering, but it doesn't see the immensity of human suffering as ineluctable. I think a tragic view sees good and evil as in equipoise with one another, and ultimately wants to rise, you know, as in Nietzsche's title, Jenseits Guten Böse, you know, beyond good and evil. I think Jews have to solidly stake themselves on the side of the good as an ultimate principle. And I think Plato is a pagan who's a guide to the ultimacy of the good. The skeptics, for example, Sextus Empiricus is not. So it depends on your pagan. But I mean, in general, I think I define myself as a Jewish philosopher, not as a Jewish theologian, because I don't want to simply take off and, from a revealed text and apply critical standards to a revealed text. I want any revealed text to be in conversation with non-revealed texts all the way down, and to sort of work up the chimney with my back against one wall and my feet against the other, and try to make both of these texts or these kinds of traditions work together. So this Vedic, even dogma in the best sense, I think this is more the work of philosophy than of theology. So that's what you mean by conversation with the Greeks. I'm at least half colonized by Greeks. I'm a Greek colony. Well, I don't know if there's what I read from the book tries to make the case that the communal practices of religious persons are worlds in which human beings can learn what it is to be effective agents, social beings. They're kind of public spaces in Hannah Arendt's sense, in which we appear to one another and become rational and effective agents in each other's presence through an engagement in common projects. I think all of that is productive of hope, both when it succeeds and when it fails. So I'm drawing here on this is a ton of so-called civil society theory in political science. Alistair MacIntyre is part of that, that looks at enclaves that may not be very democratic in their fundamental values, like the Roman Catholic Church. There's nothing democratic about the Roman Catholic Church. But people can learn values, they can learn how to do things, they can learn to have confidence in these non-democratic settings that then spill over very effectively in a liberal democratic. The know-nothings in the 19th century made the false claim that because Catholics come out of a non-democratic ecclesial culture, they would not be fit citizens of a democracy. they wouldn't have the values or the civic virtues to act as democratic citizens. This was a false reading because they assumed that there had to be a kind of isomorphism between the values within a religious community and the values of the civic sphere. It turns out to be false. Having said that, however, Jews actually, I think, did very well in modern liberal constitutional, more or less democratic orders from the very beginning. I mean, you see this in Abravanel, admiring the Venetian Republic and trying to deconstruct monarchy and seeing the Jewish political tradition as ideally republican rather than monarchic. There, with a Jewish emphasis on literacy, on participation, on a kind of equality, at least among males, these are all very proto-democratic sort of traits. So a given practice that lends itself to hope, I don't know, liturgical practices and see, although that's not exactly what Alistair MacIntyre means.
Now, I'm thinking about bodies of literature that tell you how to do this virtue.
So, no.
Yeah.
There are no treatments of hope in Jewish virtue literature. It's just in the it's in the cracks. I mean, I have a friend he's an Orthodox rabbi who's the rabbinic advisor to the Federation in Chicago, Yechiel Pupko, and I told him a few years ago I was working on this book, and he just threw his hands up. He says, "Hope is not a Jewish value." I mean, I think Jews have lived greatly by hope. They just haven't theorized it a lot, and that's probably because we don't have as theory-hungry a tradition as the Catholic tradition, the patristic literature, with a fusion in Greek philosophy early on. Eitan?
Well, I've seen it in terms of the way it's concretized liturgically, right? It's itself a kind of book, kind of practice, and kind of embedded philosophy. It functions around the point of the liturgization of redemption or the hope for redemption, messianism, and then the most concrete, right, is sort of the pushback against the all too present resistance against mortality, right, in the sense of the constant affirmation of fiat and nekim in the liturgy.
Yes.
I was thinking of, let's say, right, an existentialist like Miguel Unamuno, his tragic sense of life, right, yeah. he says that fundamentally human beings experience life as tragic and hopeless because they experience mortality as a structure of their existence. So it's an interesting contrast to both to what's structured into the language of the tradition, but then how the interplay is between that element of the existentialist dilemma and other sources of hope.
When you go through the liturgy, I mean, you can imagine over the 3 or so years I was writing this book, every time the word hope cropped up somewhere, I was, keen to make a mental note of it. So I still do this. So Pasuke de Zimra, for example, there's a fair amount of hope that crops up in those psalms. There are three main roots for hope. I mean, we all know Kufav Hey, Tikva, but there's more in there as well. So, in the rabbinic prayers, I think the most massive is in Modim here. Ulamal Shinim Al Tehi Tikva, for those enemies of the Jews who are selling us out, there should be no hope. It's not exactly positive, but you can infer from the negative the presence of a positive. I think in a way, the lack of explicit hope words, the relative paucity of them is a, is a good thing, because again, hope does not mean, in the deepest sense, personal hope for some favorable outcome. It is a stance of affirmation. It is an existential orientation that's grounded in a conviction, in a faith, in a confidence that life at base is this rather than that, that life has a goodness that supports the articulations of goodness, the enactments of goodness, the doing of goodness that we want to make. I take issue a little bit with the contemporary, recently deceased philosopher Richard Rorty in the book, who actually wrote a book called Philosophy and Social Hope, which he tries to argue that we can maintain hopefulness, robust hope, in the complete absence of any kind of underlying story, let alone metaphysics, to ground the story. It's just an act of sheer will, but it seems to me this hope, on my view, has nothing to do with optimism. Optimism is a psychological state. It's a disposition of one's constitution. There are gloomy people and there are cheerful people. There are optimists, there are pessimists. I suppose optimists may have a slightly easier time rising to hope as a virtue, but hope as a virtue is something you have to reason your way toward as a way of organizing your intuitions and your deepest sense of what life is. And you have to give it a name and you have to be able to defend it as one would defend any other virtue. Why is humility better than pridefulness? Why is prudence better than recklessness? The phronimos, the virtuous man in Aristotle, can give an account of why one is superior to the other. Oot, you have a question. Yes, I mean, it's clear that in the Enlightenment, the idea of providence was secularized into the idea of progress. The problem, and there have been any number of very worthy books written about, you know, the secularization process. In the American setting, I'd mention Christopher Lash's book, it's called The One and Only Heaven, which is a study of the rise and decline of the concept of progress in America, American literature, and American. Another book by a scholar over at Columbia, Andrew Del Banco, what's the book called? It's about hope in America. So all of these sort of contemporary studies of hope point to the secularization of providential motifs into various modern surrogates. The problem is, traditional Jews can still hope for the Messiah or a messianic age, but secular moderns who've given up on in the investment of hope in progress, who've come to see progress as sort of a false god, what do they have? What's left over? When we read thinkers who are heavily invested in progress as a messianic surrogate, like Condorcet, a French philosopher, or Immanuel Kant, people I deal with in the book, they appear very naive nowadays. So it's a question that Lash raises, and Nisbet, and Delbanco, and others. How could Americans or other modern Westerners who've been through secularization sustain a robust public hope in the absence of some kind of faith, like the faith in progress, which has been discredited? And there's an emerging literature in social theory, in economics, in political theory, asking this question: is it possible for us to hope for our future in a large sense, or is hope reduced to something small and private, like I hope I can afford a Mercedes-Benz someday? So I in a way try to enter that debate and offer something that's religious at its core, but doesn't sort of, you know, stick the religion in your face too much. I would try to argue for it. I just say one thing about messianism within a traditional setting. In the section I do on you know, the rabbis, I suggest that the Neusner's way of reading rabbinic Judaism as a sort of structure for the sanctification of life in the here and now, in which messianic realization in the future is put on the back burner, if not bracketed out altogether. That's actually pretty useful, because it corresponds to this duality of mind between very much a future orientation and this sort of structuring of life in the present. So if Christianity is really a messianic faith, Judaism is not just a religion that differs over the, in a way, it's a religion that differs over the saliency of the concept of the Messiah in the first place.
Thank you very much.
Very welcome.